certainly one of the factors was, I mean, the first two books came out in 1970 and 1972.
Right.
And then there's a pause while I was retooling. But also during that period, I got divorced and contrived to bring my children to live with me, not the summers, but through the school years. And so I became, had to deal with the consequences of and responsibilities for a divorce. I had to deal with my own children, which drove me into a more urgent, considerable curiosity about childhood than I would have had merely on my own. It meant moving a couple of times. And so the textures of those things seem to me not to be possible to pick those things up, not as subject matter, but as the ethos of the poems, the things that matter to me a lot in my life that I wanted to be able to write about so that I could be as smart about them as I could and possibly even smart enough to stop trying to be smart about them when that was the right move to make, etc. I mean, but I was trying, I wanted very much to do a good job raising the kids. And to figure out how it was that I had, how it was that I found myself in this situation, which had, in some ways, had kind of an awful rhyme for me with the decision to go to graduate school, which seems like such a wise decision, and then suddenly was insupportable. And I'd had a marriage which I had entered with every optimism and affection go sour in a short period of time, and I thought, you know, I've done this again. What's going on here? You can't be this ignorant. You need to know something you don't know.
Yeah.
And since at that point, I was beginning to figure out that poems were a way of thinking, it seemed natural to want to write different kinds of poems under a different set of urgencies. And they were very much had people in them and social consequences, and they were about, you know, different experiences of time, and and they're about loyalty and betrayal. And I mean, I needed to be able to address all those things, not by a series of explicitly autobiographical poems.
Right.
There's not much of a paper trail, though anybody reading those books would know that the books were their two male children very much at the heart of the author's life, and that questions of what at home is and isn't are very important. But other than that, there aren't autobiographical poems about, you know, divorce fights. The facts are not there.
Right. Is that a product of your process or something more intentional? In other words, your subject matter ends up being sort of
Well, I think both.
Provisional, right?
I think both. I mean, you, you know, out of boredom, you guys stop writing a certain kind of poem and you think, well, what am I going to do next? And you write down what's in your head, and what's in your head is necessarily close to the kinds of things that are worrying you. And that part is quite unintentional. Though it's very likely, in fact, to produce, to put before you this subject matter that you can't evade. It's like so-called free associations. It works because it's not free, it's absolutely determined. You know, that was how I knew to write in those years. I would write something down that interested me and think, what the hell, where did that come from and what could go with it? So it was scarcely automatic writing, but there was a sense that, you know, I didn't have any idea where I was going to go, and I hadn't shown much interest in writing poems in traditional form, so I was unwilling to let the solving of formal problems try and lead me to subject matter, as under some circumstances it will do rather neatly.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the skill or the curiosity to do that. So, and then in another sense, I think it's very deliberate. You think, you know, I need to understand the conditions of my life better.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore I'll try writing about them, since the major tool I had for understanding was writing poems.
Well, that's what often happens after Rising and Falling, I guess, is that, and also I think in later poems, like Whiplash and Bystanders, it's an engagement with narrative, but they're poems that start with that lengthy kind of anecdotal piece, but they seem very much a variety of a cautionary tale. It's as if you tell the stories in order to warn us or remind us about human folly, nature, fate.
Mm-hmm. Or to remind me. I mean, I think one advantage, narrative interest in this is receding, but there's been a period recently when some people have spoken of narrative as if it were valuable in and of itself, a position that I don't understand. But there may be one way in which I sort of understand it. It's always seemed to me that poems written by those folks are a kind of spilt religion. And I think in hindsight, one reason I was interested in narrative is not because of a storytelling impulse. I like the condensing and compressing of the powers of poetry a lot, and they tend to run counter, like an ebb tide to narrative. But narratives are about consequences in some way. This A happens before B. Is it that A caused B, or is it accidental that A and B are in that relation? Those kinds of things, when you think, how is it that I'm in this situation in my life, a rhetorical procedure which allows you to think about consequence and action and choice was very interesting to me. And more than anything else in narrative, I think that's what I was attracted to.
Is that what Rick Jackson talks about, as a rhetorical narrative in your work? That's how the poems proceed?
I suspect so. I think so. When I think of Rick's recent poems, which are a kind of tease narrative, in which a narrative is offered to you and something else is given to you, I'm not entirely sure I know what he means by rhetorical narrative. I happen to like those poems of his.
Yeah.
But they operate in a very different way. I mean, the cautionary tale is a phrase I like. You can, in fact, tell yourself how to be, you know, wiser and better. And if you could, you would just drive yourself nuts. I never liked it when other people did it for me. I suppose I'd really hate it if I was the one telling me what was good for me. But the cautionary tale can remind you that your urge to control and to understand things is subject to all kinds of misfirings, to effects which are unintentionally comic in the way that the comic or the antic has a disrupting smoothness, mm-hmm. disrupting placidity, requiring you to lose and recover your balance. I don't think of the comic impulse in writing as being anything like relief or a range of tone, but it actually embodies and imitates a kind of moral balance that we have all the time, which is that you're continually losing your sense of balance and certainty and poise, and you need to recover it. And the fact that we use jokes to deal with the subject matters we find the most unsettling and most threats to our poise, sex, death, etc. The comic impulse is a deeply serious one in poetry, and particularly when the temptation to pontificate now that you've got the soapbox out is a problem.
Right.
So that the episodes in these cautionary tales are, in a grim way, quite funny, which seems to me the case in Whiplash, for example, made them all the more attractive to me. The narrative impulse, in some way, may be comic. It may indicate an attempt to make a more credible, consequence-identifiable narrative out of life than life ever actually provides us with. So there's something hubristic and comic about the urge to tell stories. And if I could tell stories which included that comical caution against relying too much on storytelling, then I would be a lot happier. Of course, the Deep Image poem has very little room for the antic or the comic, and that was its other temperamental defect for me from the beginning.
Well, the notion of the cautionary tale, too, has a lot of links to Freud, you know, who's been one of your most abiding influences. A lot of Freud's case studies read like a variety of fables.
They are fables in some way. Sort of Aesop or an acid. the Wolfman could be described as. I think they're very beautiful as narratives,
mm-hmm.
and they have in them, because the kinds of behavior he's dealing with have a coherence, but not a coherence that's immediately available. There's a series of disjunctions and comic misunderstandings mm-hmm. are available. I mean, I think of them as very beautiful narratives without a lot of other parallels, though many Kafka's fables, sort of paradoxical fables, come to mind. And Freud's writing on dreams and on jokes and their relation to the unconscious were things that made absolute sense to me when I read them. I was about 14 when I read that stuff, and there was much I didn't understand. I was too close to puberty to understand how complicated his model for the pull of the erotic was. I didn't understand until the next time I went back to read that stuff that almost all his models of intellectual activity were transactional, and that they were, you know, either it's like money was changing hands or water was seeking a different level. I didn't understand how active they were as models, but I knew right away that the dream stuff about dreams and the stuff about jokes was true in some way, because language was, I think, what I knew the most about, though I didn't know what I knew, and I didn't know how to say what I did or didn't know. But when I read those things, I thought, yes, this makes sense to me. And the other stuff was, you know, it's like Stevens, I would have to go back to it. It was just too grown up for me.
Mm-hmm. I think I read once where Peter Stitt described Happy Childhood as a book that sort of attempted to unburden yourself almost of your passion and interest in Freud. I mean, it was, as you began to write poems that were more investigative at that point.
I mean, I never felt it a burden. I'm one of the few admirers of Freud who refuses to be embarrassed by him. And the sort of lazy wholesale bashing of Freud by usually not the brightest feminists, it seems to me disgraceful. This is a major writer before we even ask how great a scientist or a psychologist it was, and a very important figure and a real pioneer, and it's a fascinating life, which he allows us to see much more of than almost any other public figure who's a writer I can think of. There's the least amount of defensiveness. Freud made all kinds of dumb moves and decisions, and by and large was very candid about almost every one of them. I mean, he's the last person people should attack, because he was the person quickest to doubt himself. I think of A Happy Childhood as a book about the need we have stories, fables, explanations, and names, and the damage those needs do to us. And that it was a book designed to unburden myself of feeling in some way uncomfortable by that both of those things were true. And it was a book designed to make me align myself with the obvious truth that both of those things are true and you can't get rid of either of them. There's a line in that poem that Freud is a student of self-deception, which seems to me one way to describe Freud at his grandest and most heroic, and therefore it is most comic, because we're always stupid when we're like that. So in that sense, if I could write a book in which I would put some of that stuff behind me, since Freud was a tutelary figure for me, then Freud would appear less frequently in the poems after that. But I don't think of Freud as a figure too great for us lesser folks to chuck off. I happily await the time when Freud's follies having been pointed out by all and sundry, everybody will remember what a great man this was.
Well, we could also talk about this notion of the cautionary tale as a form employed in your poems about jazz musicians, about writers, sports figures. I often focus on great artists who, because of age or addiction or some sort of human failing, they're in decline. Time and Money has a poem called Babe Ruth toward the end, and you know, you have that earlier poem about Bud Powell, you give him a heroin habit that he didn't actually have.
Well, actually, there's some debate about this. The story in the jazz community, sort of the insider's story in the jazz community, and this came up when the Bud Powell Verb set that came out about a year ago, produced, and the guy who put that together called Al Young, and he wanted to use part of Al Young's poem in the liner. It's elaborately produced, if you've seen it. And Al said, oh, I have a friend who's got a poem about Bud Powell. You should use it. And the guy called me up and he says, your poem is the best poem I've looked at for this anthology, but I'm not going to use it because... And then I'd heard this story from other people. I said, because Powell snorted heroin, but never shot up. And I've always thought that there's the insistence on this. There's something hagiographical about this. For a short poem, I threw in the heroin addiction because it always seemed to me possible that he was more involved with heroin than people had said. And also, in a short poem, I thought it would help not to just have him be depressed, but to have him be in a more melodramatic form and trapped by himself.
Yeah.
I mean, if your pal, who was, when he was on, was one of our four or five greatest jazz pianists, you know, it was great, and you were rapt, and your full attention was there. And then when you quit playing, you were just a depressed guy who couldn't manage his own life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a way in which all those poems about artists are cautionary tales about the difference between you're a writer when you have a pen in your hand, and the rest of the time you're just a biped. And it's hard for us to remember that for some reason, and which must be why I tell myself the story so frequently in those poems.
You do this a lot. I mean, you write about these sports figures, these musical figures, in ways that italicize that sort of region of that where the tragedy of their lives and the consolation they receive from art is sort of at its most present. I mean, are you conscious of in some ways ennobling those figures as people who have achieved a kind of mastery that in some ways serves them and traps them?
Yeah. I mean, and I do think it's a trap. I think most of the, not all by any means, but most of the great artists for whom we have reliable and empathetic and good-hearted and well-researched biographies, you know, you're sort of in the company of a monster while you're reading these books about these people.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people for whom this is not true. When the big, huge Verdi biography came out about a year and a half ago, and I read through the Verdi biography, I thought, well, this guy was no... I mean, I might rather go bowling with St. Paul than with Verdi. I mean, he wasn't a lot of fun. But this was no monster. And there are people who are not like this. I don't think that, you know, being being an artist and taking your own pleasure at making things seriously is necessarily makes you a monster. But it has made huge numbers of people into monsters. And only a few of those people have had a talent large enough to be a consolation for what bastards they became. They say, you know, absolute power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But what most people say when they think that is power corrupts others. Absolute power corrupts others, absolutely. But the truth is, all these rules are for us, too. If large numbers of people are driven to a kind of low-grade monsterhood, mm-hmm. and you want to do this for the rest of your life, you better damn well be on guard. I mean, I think that's what they're about. It's parallel to something I think about a lot at my age, which will be 53 next month, that most of the people older than I am in my department are bitter and unhappy. And I look at the remaining years that I may wind up teaching and think there's got to be a way not to do this. Right. What is it? And I think in this way, as the poems that start with Rising and Falling, which begin to include my sons and my domestic life and so forth, much more than the earlier poems, there's this sense in which you're working out of very direct and practical concerns. And I probably have written more of those poems about musicians and composers and athletes in the last few years, partly because this is a problem that becomes very apparent at the stage in life that I'm at now. And I think, you know, there's got to be a way not to get caught in this. I, of course, don't know whether there is, but it would be a hell of a lot better to imagine that there's one and look for it than to just let it sweep over you like some kind of dreadful mental plague. And, you know, I think a lot of poets, there are counterexamples. I mean, I see Galway here in the city, and he's gracious, he's generous, his last book was, I think, his very best. Better than the Book of Nightmares, I think. And, you know, Jerry, there's Phil Levine, Carolyn Kaiser. I know a lot of poets who are pretty content, but I know a lot of poets in that age bracket who are grumpy and who can tell you, list off every prize they've not won, and can't get to a conversation without chopping off two poets of about the same age and status as the knees. And you think, you know, there's a lot to watch out for. That's where the cautionary tales come from. I mean, I don't imagine that I'm immune to any of this stuff, and it scares me.
Yeah, I'm conscious of it already. Then walking down the halls of my department.
Now, I've never been in a department where walking through the halls didn't feel like you're like swimming in a pond in the summer where there's like warm spots and then there's something cold spots. And you don't know where they are until you go through them. Going down the halls in one's department is like that. You think, oh, here's where Baxter Hathaway had sold at Archie Ammons 22 years ago.
It's too bad. You talked about how you're... In some ways, these poems about artists and sports figures have occurred recently because they needed to, because things you're trying to work out in your life. Have you, in some ways, have your ambitions for what you think of as poetry's mission changed in the last few years? In the new book, you make some comments about what poetry can do. For instance, the world's a poem you never learn to write, and then this is in the Rookery of Hunt. And then the comment about... Verses easy and poetry is hard, brash choir and a polyphonic heart beats loudly in the trees and does not ask what poetry can do and comes from making nothing happen. The rooks and I rejoice not to be near. I mean, that seems to be saying something about why we make art and what the mission of art is.
Some of it is bird life. You know, that. But the song is, I'm here I am.
Yes.
And pleased to be conscious again.
Sometimes that seems like enough.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a small thing. I mean, I do think that writing poetry imitates, in some ways, the process of keeping alert, keeping your poise, keeping your curiosity, keeping all the balls up in the air. It's a model for an attentive life, and that it acts it out. If we were to say what kind of symbolic actions Mr. Burke can perform, the first thing I would say is I would use images from juggling and images from choreography and say, you know, that balance and posture in the largest sense of the word, poise in the largest sense of the word, are some of the things that the writing of poetry teaches us. It also teaches us a certain ordinary bravery, which is not to call a spade a garden implement and not to leave out the stuff that you don't know the answer to and things like that. It is good for the human spirit to speak the truth in public in an unquavering voice. And that writing imitates some of that, especially forget that after, you know, a long department meeting or any number of places where public speech happens, where the rule seems to be not to speak, to speak as little of the truth as possible, and never to say what the real issues are. And so I think poetry does a lot of things in that way. It works. I've always liked the phrase symbolic action, though I don't think I mean by it exactly or anything close to exactly what Kenneth Burke had in mind. But it does seem to me to imitate one's curiosity, one's moral alertness, one's generosity. It reasserts the power of laughter in the face of terrible things that life can do to people. I think it does a lot of things. Auden was wrong. It's not true that poetry makes nothing happen. It tends to work its wonders in a very small arena. You know, it makes you more interesting to yourself and you and me at its best. And, you know, it doesn't persuade anybody to reinstate the funds for the National Endowment for the Arts.
Right.
But the power that it does have is very real. And it has the power to perform a kind of cleansing or rinsing of the sort for which, for a long part of human history, we had only images of theological intervention to describe. Obviously, people knew that something important had happened to them, so you attach it to the highest available power. If it's this good for you, it must come from a great place. But it turns out, as prayer might have suggested to those folks, it can be instigated by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a necessary social component because language is social and historical. So that while these activities take place in solitude, there's a sense in which you're in a company the whole time. The language represents the other people who aren't there physically. And I think that's actually a lot. Poetry can do a lot.
And it's something that I was thinking of asking you later, because I read this line of Milosz's where he talks about poetry's role for educated people today being something like Gnosticism was for early Christians. In some ways, what you just said speaks to us.
That's a very, yes. It's a, and we are sort of like the Essenes, aren't we, in that sense.
Well, yeah, that other line in Time and Money that sort of suggests that poetry is trying to improve on the babble that issues like a dial tone from our body.
Mm-hmm.
This empty talk that surrounds us in certain objects.
Our sense of that may be fairly recent in human history, that the amount of babble that you can, starting from the paper on the doorstep, which I am addicted to reading to start the day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if I spurn this stuff. I turn on the television, which I don't think is the devil's instrument. Much of it's dull, but that's another problem. The access that people, I mean, it's one reason why I have eschewed the fax machine, and I'm still on the outer net, is that I feel the world can get to me all too readily as it is,
mm-hmm.
and the need to be able to distinguish between meaningful noise and what is like a sort of nearly electronic noise, like a dial tone figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in nomadic tribes 16 centuries ago had nothing of this problem. You know, and they were in danger of hearing divine voices because there was not enough stimulation going on. So, I mean, I think in some ways this is a recent phenomenon, but it's a very real one. It's a danger that language can be debased just by the sheer torrent of it that we're technologically capable of bombarding ourselves with.
Hey, it seems to be more and more the project of a lot of poets, to sort of, in some ways, privilege the subjective, sort of resurrect the debate of the natural.
See
it more and more. And even, I think, some of the experiments that we don't approve of, perhaps, are find less interesting, are still somewhat there.
Oh yeah, no, those are desperate moves.
Yeah.
And I don't think the desperation that the poets who make them feel is illusory in any sense. It's not what I would do in the same situation, but I understand why they're doing things that they want to see as extreme, because extreme measures of some kind or other are required.